Jakob, how you doing there, my man?
Doing well. Good to see you, Jacob.
Likewise, always good to connect. I want to just open up with a banger question, partially philosophical, I think, around store value versus medium of exchange. Everyone talks about like this kind of like trajectory of money, goes through like these three phases, and different subsets of Bitcoin focus on different parts of it. A lot of us focus on the MOE part, like using Bitcoin for money. But others just like treat like digital gold, collateralize against it. That's how the people are going to use it. What's your current kind of stance? How do you see Bitcoin playing out on like a longer time horizon of these two things?
Yeah, I think that what you mentioned there is there's an adoption curve to money, and that's how I see it. I think if you want to transfer value, something first has to actually hold value, and so it has to become a store of value first. And I think that is what Bitcoin is in the process of doing, and it's somewhat custom built for, right? It's like custom built to be the best store of value in the world because it's strictly limited in supply, like nothing else there is, and completely fungible. And so I think that we're in the adoption phase of Bitcoin as a store of value asset. It's probably going to take some more time. More institutions, more people around the world are realizing that is the best place to hold value for the long term. And I'm convinced that Bitcoin will become the medium of exchange and unit of account of the world. Like we're going to a hyper Bitcoinization where we fully adopt Bitcoin as a medium of exchange and unit of account, but that is, I would think, decades away, and so it doesn't really make sense to jump the gun and, in my opinion, use Bitcoin for payments or for transferring value right now, at least not at scale, because it is not the unit of account. Right? The unit of account is still the dollar, globally. Obviously, that there's a lot of changes happening also as we speak, but that is what folks denominated their portfolios in. That's what they denominate their expenses in. That's what they denominate also their loans and financial products in. And so that's what they want to transfer. And we're seeing that, right? And we'll get into stablecoins and the adoption of stablecoins. We're seeing stablecoins as the killer app for payments, for remittances, for a lot of these use cases, and not Bitcoin. And I don't think it's not really a debate at this point, if you just look at the market data. I'm a fan of just looking at the market. What is the market telling us? The market's telling us Bitcoin is being adopted as a store of value. Stablecoins and dollars are adopted for medium of exchange and the unit of account. So that's how I see it.
Interesting. So you think, and the market seems to bear that out. So you think a lot of the, because I'm looking at, I spend most of my time talking to founders and looking at kind of like where adoption is going to come from. And it seems like, you do have, BTC Pay Server making it easy to accept Bitcoin on your website, and it works relatively well, or Lightning. Like, if you can set up your channels, it works relatively well. But I can't help shake the feeling that we're over optimizing for MOE on Bitcoin too early, and maybe we should be going the kind of like what Stripe has recently announced, where like they're getting pretty heavy into the crypto side, probably through stablecoins. Do you agree with that sentiment? Like, maybe in the interim, we should see more companies leaning into getting off of TradFi rails and do stablecoin rails as like a way to go into BTC MOE?
Yeah, absolutely. That's how we see it too at Hermetica. We see it as, in the interim, we'll have stable coins or dollars as the medium of exchange. And so fully lean into that and actually build stable coins that are actually backed by Bitcoin and are running on Bitcoin. That's what we have brought to market. And yeah, I mean, Stripe just acquired Bridge for $1.1 billion, which is basically Stripe for stable coins. And so it's pretty obvious PayPal has launched their stable coin. It's pretty obvious that a lot of folks are really excited about stablecoins because if you look at the data and you look at emerging markets especially, there's a really cool report that came out from Castle Island Ventures a couple of months back that looks at emerging market adoption for stablecoins. Highly recommend to read that. And it's fascinating because a lot of folks think that stablecoins are used to get into crypto, and that is certainly a use case. Like, folks want to get stablecoins so they can buy Bitcoin or other crypto assets and interact in those economies. But what that paper shows is that there's a pretty big adoption outside of that use case, which means it's actually completely unrelated to DeFi and the crypto ecosystem. It's just folks want to hold dollars. And if you are not in the Western world, you don't have access to dollars, or not, at least not in an easy way. And maybe we can talk a little bit about my background at some point, but I had a very visceral experience of that because I worked in Africa for a while and nobody has access to dollars. But now you can, like, and you see that in Nigeria, you know, there's a ton of adoption of folks that want to hold dollars in their wallet as a replacement for a bank account, and then they can then transact with that, send it abroad, send it to their family, settle trade, all that good stuff, and then also earn yield and save. So it's really a replacement for bank accounts, and I think that is, I mean, that's the biggest financial product in the world.
Yeah, so this is actually super, something I've been thinking about as well. It's super interesting is when you talk to normies about Bitcoin, like, one, they'll be like, oh, this guy, don't, please don't, I'm not ready for this. Like, they don't want to hear about the scams, the NFTs, all this stuff. But one thing that hits you when you start to talk about, like, the financial system and the Fed is, like, nobody thinks, they think about the dollars in their account, I need more of them. They don't think about the money, like, what is the money in their account? That's this whole separate question that they don't have the time to think about. And that got me thinking, like, there's something about stablecoins, and as you mentioned, like, people want a dollar. They want the brand that is the dollar at some level, because if you have your current currency, you have the dollar, then you have these other random assets that are super volatile. I just want to get out of the volatility that is my current currency into something more stable. But no one really talks about that. Like, they don't really talk about the dollar as, like, a brand, or, like, people don't just want a stable coin. Like, they actually want a dollar because it's this kind of, like, reserve currency that they could trust.
Yeah. And they can transact with it worldwide. Everybody accepts it. And as you said, their local currency is getting inflated. They don't trust their government. And so trust another government, even though that is probably not the absolute best alternative, but is a lot better than trusting your Nigerian government or Argentinian government that has inflated the currency at, like, over 100% year over year, right? And the dollar is not inflating at 100%, at least not yet. So it is, and it's just, like, I don't think it's much of a debate. It's just, look at the data. That's what folks are doing, and it makes a ton of sense. I would want to do that. If I were in emerging markets, I would want to hold dollars, not my local currency.
Yep. It's the rational thing. No, this is cool. Then, actually, I do want to touch on your background a little bit, because you have a pretty interesting background. You've been an entrepreneur for a while. Give us some color on your background and, like, leading into how you got into Bitcoin.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll take a little bit of a longer tour because we have some time here. Been an entrepreneur, actually. There's stories from my mom that, you know, I was, like, buying and selling things when I was, like, in the 6-7 years old. But I really started my first business, I think, when I was 13. I had, like, long hair. I think you remember me with long hair, right? Mm-hmm. Long hair. I have, like, rich locks. And I was playing soccer as a 13-year-old. And
you so pull I off bought, like, both well, by the way.
Thank you. I bought, like, a headband to, like, hold back my hair when I play soccer. And when I looked at it, I was like, this is just an elastic band that is sewed together. I can do this myself. I can produce this. So I asked my mom to show me how to sew, and bought some elastic bands, and I produced headbands in my bedroom and sold them on eBay when I was 13. And that was my first business. It was actually quite successful. I made, like, a couple hundred dollars. I was super happy about it and learned about, you know, copywriting, like, get the headband like the soccer superstars, and did some accounting. And that was, I always had that, you know, that bug of wanting to build stuff and sell it. And then actually had to shut it down at some point because I got tired of sewing headbands. And I asked my sister if she wants to work for me. And she was like, too expensive. I ran the numbers. I was like, that's not going to work. So I had to shut that one down. And then, you know, did, like, other said buying, I was arbitraging the first iPhone when it came out. I was buying it in the UK and importing it to Germany and selling it for $200 more a pop. Mm-hmm. So I did that a couple of times and bought my first iPhone that way. That was really cool. And so always had a little bit those side hustles on this going. I went to engineering school at some point. That was like the least entrepreneurial time of my life, I guess. But then in my 20s got involved, in 21, 22, I got involved in a project that brought me to the emerging markets. We had technology to produce very cheap eyeglasses that we brought into Africa, South America, Bangladesh, and produced eyeglasses for a dollar in those countries and then sold them locally, prescription eyeglasses. And since there's really almost no eyeglasses in the developing world, it's like basically non-existent, we were able to sell a lot of them and distribute them all over the world. Sold over 250,000 eyeglasses. And the really cool part was that it brought me to like some of the most remote places in the world, right? We would like do outreaches and go into the wilderness in Burkina Faso, in like the Sahara, essentially. And I was like 22-year-old white guy, and I didn't see a white person for like weeks. And it was like just amazing experiences, amazing people. And then seeing, you know, these kind of folks, like folks that literally live in huts and bank account, what is this? Like, what are you talking about? They're sending money on their phone, actually, right? They actually have a form of bank account, which is the credits on their phone, which they're sending to their neighbors or to other people in the city. But it allowed me to see economies that are much less developed, financial systems that are much less developed, but also much more controlled by other entities. In Burkina, in West Africa, the currency is still controlled and issued by France. And so it's like interesting, right? Like there's definitely power structures that exercise control over the financial system. And you know, you can read that in a textbook, but if you see it viscerally, if you like go through the city and everybody living in poverty, but then you go into the city center and the restaurants are all full of white French people, it's like, okay, interesting. You know, you start putting one and one together. And so that gave me, I think, a very good background for grokking Bitcoin very quickly. So when I found Bitcoin 2016, it clicked very quickly. And obviously, you know, it's like interesting from an engineering perspective, super interesting how you can build this and like distribute it, and it's not controlled by anybody. But then also on the economic level, this can actually be a technology that can serve these kinds of economies and people to bring them into a financial system that is not controlled by another country outside of your reach in Europe, for example. So I fell in love with Bitcoin, really, and still am in love 8 years later, 9 years later, and dedicated myself to first studying it, because I think there's so many things, and you know, you do this super well in your podcast, to like just look at all the different facets of Bitcoin. There's so many facets of Bitcoin. You can like spend years just talking about it and learning it. So dove into a bunch of different elements of it, studied cryptography, studied the Bitcoin core node, started a mining company because I wanted to understand what mining is, which was quite interesting business lesson as well. And then got into trading the asset, trading the futures markets, and ended up working at Kraken, the exchange, for a while, where I got exposed, I would say, to the rest of crypto. Kraken obviously is a Bitcoin first company, or at least was founded that way, but now it's in everything, right? Any crypto assets, any blockchain. So got exposed to Ethereum, DeFi, Solana, NFTs, all that fun stuff. And that really also then exposed me to the idea of building on Bitcoin, or building a decentralized financial system on Bitcoin. Stacks, Rootstock, those projects really inspired me, which then finally led me to leave Kraken in 2022 and start Hermetica, and that's what we are today. And that's our goal, to build on Bitcoin. So,
dude, that's a hell of a journey. Very cool. I definitely feel a kinship to the eBay life. For a while I was doing hitting up real estate in my local area, and then just like flipping shit on eBay for, you know, buying a VCR DVD combo player for $20 and then flipping it for $200.
Yep.
So like I made my first like, you know, 40K or something doing that. And then I'm like, I actually don't want to have like a basement full of just random shit that is like might or might not sell. So let me go into this tech thing.
Yeah, it's not scalable, yeah, basically.
No, no. And I felt stuck. I was like, this is an anchor that I got to carry with me wherever I go. I want to live laptop life. So maybe Bitcoin. So that's cool. I want to start to touch in, like, deep dive into Hermetica, but I want to go about it kind of roundabout way because it's super interesting when you talk about, like, city life, French, like, different connection to even going, you know, 30 minutes out and, like, how different people, like, kind of like in the rural areas might live. And I see that it's all over the place and everywhere. Like, you see it in politics, you see it in Bitcoin, where it's like, stable coins are stupid, just buy Bitcoin, dumbass. And it's like, well, sure, in your perspective, that makes perfect logical sense, but you're in your little bubble and you can't expand, like, your perspective to include other views that would be contrary to yours. So all that to say, like, give us a little more color on, like, through that lens of, like, Bitcoin and stablecoins, because I do agree stablecoins have reached pretty good product market fit, but, like, certain subsets still view it as just, like, a wasted effort, stupid. And it seems like part of it is that, like, they just have their worldview. They're the French in the city, so they can't relate to the other perspective. Any thoughts on that framing?
Yeah, I think there's always folks that think things are stupid, and obviously they're entitled to their opinion, but I think at the end of the day, what is important is what people do, not what people think. Like, we can sit around and philosophize all day, and that's interesting for a little bit, not that interesting to me, actually, but if you look at what people do, if you just actually look at the on-chain data, it's 50% of on-chain transaction volume is stablecoins. So proof is there, proof is in the pudding. If you like it or not, it is a product and an asset that has found product market fit, and it is being used in the billions of dollars by tens of millions of people all around the world, and most importantly, is solving real problems. Like, it's not, I mean, the real problem of managing portfolios, making more money, asset management. This is a real economy, very important economy. There is some people say it's not really that important. I think it is, but the real problems of how can I save my energy? How can I save my money in order to pay for my family, pay for education, you know, put my kids to school, feed my family? That is what stablecoins are used for. That's what stablecoins are used for, mainly in emerging markets, where it's essentially a replacement for a bank account. And I think that Bitcoin obviously is a fantastic technology. I think there's a lot of elements to it that are fascinating. One, it's the asset. One is a settlement layer in a network. And the other element that is super fascinating to me, that's why I'm building a stablecoin, is stablecoins, because they have that use case that actually can produce real value to folks. And if you can combine them, and that's what we've done, that's what we're doing. If you can actually have a stablecoin that is backed by Bitcoin and settles on Bitcoin, essentially transacts on Bitcoin, I think you have the best of both worlds, where you have a product market fit product like the stablecoin that people want to use, but you also still inheriting those really awesome primitives of Bitcoin that makes it very secure, very censorship resistant. And the asset Bitcoin itself is the new digital gold standard, right? And so that we're essentially going into a world where we're reissuing dollars on the gold standard. Like, we went from the gold standard into the fiat world, and now we're going back, in my opinion. That's what we're after.
Love it. And you tease out some things of, like, a Bitcoin-backed stablecoin has some advantages, but I want to make sure people have a good view of the current landscape of stablecoins, because there's, like, three main varieties, is my understanding. You have fiat-backed, which is by far the largest currently. Collateral-backed, so, like, you put up an asset, you mint against it. And then these new kind of, like, trading strategy-style ones that hedge to keep the peg. Give us some color on, like, the different types of stablecoins, because, like, they're all not built equal.
Yeah, and there's a lot of cool experiments, but there's really three buckets. As you mentioned, there is fiat-backed, RWA-backed stablecoins. You have collateralized or crypto-collateralized stablecoins, which actually delta-neutral stablecoins are also crypto-collateralized. They just add an element to it. And then there's algorithmic stablecoins, which don't have a backing in itself, things like Terra Luna and some others that I think we all now know don't work and are a failed experiment. So there's really two big buckets. There's RWA-backed stablecoins and collateralized stablecoins. They're both collateralized. It's just what you collateralize it with, right? The RWA collateralized stablecoins, you Tether, your Circle are collateralized with fiat in a bank account or treasuries or reverse repo agreements. And so they are essentially collateralized by assets in the fiat system that are, as you mentioned, that's the by far number one amount of stablecoins in circulation. Tether is $140 billion, I think. And they have a lot of liquidity, a lot of product market fit, network effects, and are very scalable because there's just a lot of liquidity in the fiat system. And so you can just on and off ramp that quite easily. They are, though, still tethered in the fiat system, right? And that is the downside. They're still actually dependent on that fiat system, one, to operate efficiently, right? Like if a bank goes down, like we saw last year in March, I think, or April, when SVB went down, that was not good for Circle. It depegged by, I think, 12%. So there's a real risk of something outside of actually the company Circle influencing the peg and quality of that product. And then the other big risk is regulatory. Like the fiat system can run well, but if the government doesn't want a specific product to exist, they can shut it down. There was actually the CEO of Tether, Arduino, I think is his name. He had an interview a couple days ago in CoinDesk where he said, yeah, if the U.S. government wants to shut down Tether, they can do so with a click of a button, which is just the reality that he acknowledges. So that's fiat-backed stablecoins. Obviously very, very interesting, and we all use them every day, including myself. The other, if you want to get out of the fiat system, the way to do it is instead of to collateralize it with fiat, you collateralize it with a crypto asset. So there's really two main ways to do that. One is you over collateralize the system, so you take Bitcoin, Ethereum, and you lock it up in a vault in a smart contract, and then you mint a stablecoin, essentially borrow a stablecoin against it at a lower value than the Bitcoin. Like say you put 1,000 Bitcoin in, you borrow $500 out of that, and now you've created a stablecoin that is backed by Bitcoin that you can transact. Bitcoin still exists, and you can redeem it back to the Bitcoins or Ethereum. That's the over-collateralized approach. I think the first big one that brought this to market was actually MakerDAO with DAI back in the days. I think it was like 2017, something like that. And there's other projects that do this in the Ethereum, Solana world. Liquidy is another one that is quite prominent. And there's a lot of them being built right now in the Bitcoin ecosystem. They are good. I think they're really interesting stablecoin approaches because they're very decentralized, right? You hold the crypto assets in on chain in a vault in a smart contract. They do come with a lot of drawdowns, though, and the main drawdowns are that they're not capital efficient, meaning that you actually have to lock up a lot more crypto assets than you can use as a stablecoin, and that is not finance likes efficiency, right? If you have capital sitting around idle and is not doing anything, that's not really that scalable. It's not that efficient. The other element is that you're introducing a leverage point, right? Like since you are borrowing the stablecoin into existence, you're actually creating leverage. And with leverage, you create a liquidation risk. Because if the Bitcoin price falls, let's say you borrow 50% and the Bitcoin price falls by 50%, now the system liquidates your Bitcoin position. And that as a user, speaking from experience, can be quite stressful, right? It's like creating a leverage trade on the futures market, for example. And so in a stablecoin, if I want to hold a stablecoin, I don't necessarily want to create leverage or worry about a liquidation risk. So there's a UX problem there. The other element is that maintaining the peg or arbitraging the peg is not straightforward, because if there's a multitude of different users that create these vaults and borrow the stablecoin into existence, if you want to arbitrage the peg, you can either have a vault so everybody can arbitrage their own vault, but most people don't want to be market makers and arbitrage a peg. So what happens is that you have redemptions on all the vaults, which means that some of the people sell the crypto asset at whatever the redemption happens, some of the assets get sold which again is a bad user experience, because if you lock up your Bitcoin, you don't necessarily want it to be sold at random times, right? You actually don't want to sell it at all, most likely. So there's some critical issues, in our opinion, that make that approach less scalable and therefore less attractive to build actually a stable coin with. And the other Bitcoin collateralized approach is the delta neutral approach, where you still collateralize the system with Bitcoin, but you add an element to it which takes away the downsides that you have in the over-collateralized system. And that is you couple this spot position with a short on the futures market. So you hold Bitcoin and you short it on the futures market one-to-one, meaning you take out all the price exposure, essentially. You hold Bitcoin, you short the same amount, so no matter where the price goes, the dollar value of that Bitcoin stays the same. And if you do that, now you can actually represent 100% of the value of the Bitcoin as a stablecoin, because you basically lock in the dollar value. So it's very capital efficient. And the other element is that you don't have a liquidation point. You know, if you say futures markets, you think of leverage, you think of getting liquidated, but we actually use the futures market to take out the price exposure. So there's no liquidation whatsoever. There's no change in value due to the price. It's delta neutral in trading terms. And so you have no liquidation points, a better user experience, and arbitraging the peg is a lot easier because there's one vault, essentially. So arbitraging that is very clean. There's not multiple different vaults that are each linked to a specific person. And then as a cherry on top, you actually get paid to do so. You get a yield in the system. Whereas in the over-collateralized system, in most cases, you have to borrow the stablecoin. You actually have to pay to do that. In our system, you get paid to hold the stablecoin. So there's another cherry on top as we see it, because it's really a side effect. And we can obviously dive into how that works and why that yield is not a rug. But that's the taxonomy.
Effortlessly just broke down the entire stablecoin market. I'm just going to clip out this like 10-minute section and make it the pod. That was by far the best breakdown I've heard. So thank you for that.
Appreciate that.
I have a bunch of follow-up questions, but let's do it through the lens of Hermetica and USDH, and we can pull out specifics. So yeah, give us the overview of what is Hermetica. What is the purpose of building Hermetica?
Yeah, I mean, so our main mission is to build a decentralized financial system on top of Bitcoin. I believe that if we want to have freedom and prosperity for the human race in the long term, we need a financial system that is built on Bitcoin as the settlement layer, because that is, in my opinion, the only decentralized settlement layer that we have. And so that's our mission as a company. And in order to do that, there's obviously a different building blocks that need to be put in place for a decentralized financial system, trading infrastructure, money markets, different financial primitives. And one of the most important ones is actually a stablecoin, meaning a dollar asset that can be represented on the Bitcoin blockchain that can then be used in the different applications, can be held by folks in their wallet. And that's what we have brought to market. USDH is that stablecoin. It's a stablecoin backed by Bitcoin. We use the delta neutral Bitcoin collateralized system. So we hold spot Bitcoin. We short the futures market one-to-one. And that locks in the value of the Bitcoin in the protocol. We represent that on chain. It's live on Runes. It's live on Stack. So Bitcoin L1 and Bitcoin L2. We represent that dollar value on chain as a stablecoin. And then you can use the stablecoin to also earn yield. You can stake the stablecoin. You receive a liquid staking token that accrues the value from funding rates, which is the mechanism that generates the yield. We can dive into that a little bit more. Paid out daily just by holding the stablecoin. So the liquid staking token. So there's a stablecoin, there's a liquid staking token. So essentially a dollar asset that is still Bitcoin, and then a Bitcoin native yield instrument.
Excellent. Just taking some notes. And so let's touch on the specifics of the stablecoin piece first. The yield part's also super interesting, but the you know, you mentioned like there's the collateral type, which is usually like a smart contract. You lock up your whatever, you mint against it. There might be some redemption aspect, but that can all kind of be handled at the smart contract level. Maybe it's mostly self-custodied-ish. This introduces this trading element where it's going and taking a position. When you first hear about it, it feels like it's interacting with the TradFi world. Like, I'm not a finance guy, so that's just like big brain GigaChad stuff to me. But like, does this help me understand like what is on chain and in a smart contract? What is on crypto rails but not in the smart contract? What is TradFi? Like, any clarity there would be helpful.
Absolutely, yeah. And so, I mean, I talked about all the benefits of the delta neutral approach. There's no free lunch usually, right? So what's the drawback? What's the trade-off? The trade-off is that in order to access the liquidity for the futures markets, which is 95%+ at this point in CeFi, so venues like Binance, OKX, Deribit, BitGet, etc., in order to access that liquidity, you have to play in the CeFi world, and you can't hold the asset on chain in smart contracts. Not that there is any smart contracts on Bitcoin, but you can't hold it into vaults. So what we need to do and what we're doing is we hold the Bitcoin in institutional grade custodians, namely Seifu and Copper, and they allow us to hold Bitcoin in custody while at the same time making those Bitcoin available as margin on centralized exchanges. So you can think of it like this. You hold the Bitcoin in cold storage, and then at the same time, they become available on the exchange's margin without being on the exchange. So the coins never actually end up on the balance sheet of the exchange. And that is very important because if the exchange goes bankrupt, which we certainly have seen, our coins are not part of the bankruptcy claims, right? They're outside of that. So it allows us to trade on the exchange while reducing our counterparty risk. And so that's what we're doing. Then there's a settlement between the exchange and the custodian every day to make sure that the P&L is distributed accordingly. That's what we're doing. We hold the coins in custody. We trade on decentralized venues, which allows us to tap into billions of dollars of open interest, which we need in order to make it a scalable system. And we essentially just hold the Bitcoin. We short it on decentralized exchange one-to-one. There's no leverage. We lock in the dollar value. And that is off-chain. That has to be off-chain. That can be brought on-chain in the future. If there's pure markets that develop on-chain, we can bring this on-chain in the future and decentralize it more. It's just not there. The infrastructure is not there yet, especially not on Bitcoin. And what is on-chain is essentially our token contract. So the token that we issue is represented on-chain. That is, on the Runes side, just a simple Runes token. Very simple setup. No smart contracts there. On the Stack side, that's a SIP 10 token. And then the staking element is also on-chain. So you can go on Stacks is on-chain. On Runes, it can't be on-chain because there's no smart contracts. But on Stacks, you can come to a smart contract. You can stake your stablecoin. You get a liquid staking token automatically back. And then every day, we essentially represent the P&L, whatever we have harvested from the funding rate. We represent that on-chain, and the value of the liquid staking token goes up.
Got it. Okay, that's super helpful. On the topic of getting into the stablecoin, like for the ones that are backed by collateral, it's pretty straightforward. Like you have BTC, ideally, and then you lock it up and you get this minted stablecoin. What's the like user flow for interacting with USDH currently?
Yes. So as a normal user, you can buy USDH on the open market. It's listed on Magic Eden. There's a pool on DotSwap. So you can show up with your Bitcoin and just buy it, swap it for USDH, and now you hold USDH. So there's no interaction actually with the protocol itself. It's all on the open market, on the DeFi markets. Same on Stacks. You can take any SIP 10 asset, any Stacks asset, and swap it for USDH on Bitflow and Velar. That's where we're live today. And then come to our website, either on Runes or on Stacks. So you can come to the website and then stake the stablecoin, get the liquid staking token, and accrue the value over time. There is another primary user, we call them, which is people that can mint and redeem. These are institutional players, high net worth individuals that are actually interested in depositing Bitcoin and or redeeming Bitcoin out of the protocol and essentially arbitrage the peg. So they can buy USDH below peg, come to us and get always $1 worth of Bitcoin or any other crypto assets back for that USDH, if that makes sense. But that is not the general public.
Got it. And then talk to me about the staking side, because like one of the big, you know, it's kind of a big benefit for Tether is that when you deploy into them, they can then go do, you know, fun treasury stuff with the government and get that yield, and it doesn't get passed down to the users. So like the staking side feels like a pretty big UX improvement and like benefit for users to be able to actually like hold the dollars, but also get yield in the dollars outside of touching TradFi. So yeah, talk about that.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think it's one of the most attractive ways to earn a sustainable yield on your dollars if you just want to hold Bitcoin. Because at the end of the day, if you hold USDH, you're still holding Bitcoin, right? You're holding $1 worth of Bitcoin. And how the yield works is it's pretty straightforward. Since we're short the futures markets, there is a funding rate that we collect. So futures markets need to balance the supply and demand of the futures, like longs and shorts in the market. And since the crypto markets are structurally prone to be long, like folks want to be long the assets, they want to have long exposure to the asset. And we are essentially providing that long exposure to folks. We're selling futures to them, and they're willing to pay us for that privilege. That's how you can think of it. And that is expressed through an interest rate that is paid between longs and shorts every 8 hours in the futures markets called the funding rate. And since we're short on the futures markets, we collect that funding rate every 8 hours and then pass that on to people that stake the stablecoin. Now, how sustainable is this, right? That's the question. If you look at the historical data, 85% of funding rate environments are positive, meaning shorts get paid, and 15%, when it gets really bearish, like when FTX collapsed or there's a big bear market, it can go negative, and then we have to pay to hold the position open. What we do is we take 25% of the yield that we generate in positive funding rate environments, and we set that aside in a reserve fund. And that reserve fund is then used to buffer out the negative funding rate environments. And so, yeah, it's a crypto native yield that we don't touch any TradFi instrument. We just hold crypto on in institutional grade custody and trade on Sexus, and then pass that yield on to folks that stake the stablecoin. It's pretty straightforward.
That's super cool. Yeah, the more I hear about this finance stuff, it sounds so scary at first, but when it gets broken down, maybe you're just good at this. I got to keep giving you your flowers. It makes a lot of sense. And yeah, like this, the funding rate has some kind of downside, which as you explained is like historically it could be, you know, 10-20%-ish will be in that negative, but then you just account for that, plan appropriately, and you'll be good to go whenever, you know, rain arrives. So
exactly, but also the calculations, how they're done, like if you look at the formulas on the exchanges, how they're done, they skew positive because there's a borrow rate in there. There's like a cost of capital essentially in that formula, which means that on average over the last 5-6 years the funding rate has been around 12%, and in bear markets it can, I think in the last bear market it was around 3%. And in bull market, it can go as high as 25%. Mm. So it's quite a sustainable, pretty rich yield.
Got it. Okay. Now this is super cool. It makes me want to definitely get my hands on some USDH and move a little bit of Bitcoin out of that. What's the stablecoins at some level are like only as good as they are liquid across where people are actually transacting? So Runes and Stacks is what you currently mentioned, but like, how are you guys thinking about your rollout plan to be everywhere, if that's the plan?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as a stable coin, you kind of have to be everywhere. And we are seeing, I think, Bitcoin DeFi slowly make baby steps forward. I think Runes and Stacks ecosystem both are very small, very nascent, some very cool users, you know, very ardent people that really love the ecosystems, but there's definitely a lack of liquidity, especially on the stablecoin side, and that's what we're tackling and bringing more liquidity in. We're very keen on a lot of other L2s. There's, and you probably have a much better even overview than me, but there's a lot of them at this point, probably too many. But there's a lot of really cool ones and really good teams building. So we're in conversations with them, and some of them have not deployed yet to testnet or even mainnet. And so we're waiting for that to develop, and we'll be there where the users will be. We're Bitcoiners. We want to serve Bitcoiners, and there's going to be a lot of venues to do that.
Very cool. And certainly agree. There's too many L2s. And we'll see what makes the ecosystem, certain ecosystems pop. Like there's certain ones that do better than others, narrative wise or community or the tech. One question on that, because a lot of the L2s are like global state kind of smart contract blockchains. So the off-chain style, like a Lightning or an Arc or whatever, don't get in the mix as much. And it could just be because it's hard to program for. But like, is off-chain stuff at all on your guys' radar?
Like Lightning and Arc?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, everything is on our radar. Everything is interesting. I played with Lightning back in 2019, 2020. And I think it is a very pure technology in that it's like very Bitcoin aligned, very simple. I think it has UX problems and it hasn't seen the adoption that you would expect, right? Like there's still the same discussions that were going on 4 or 5 years ago. So I would love that to see more adoption. And then we're very keen on being part of that ecosystem. I just don't see the adoption right now. And I don't know if there's a fundamental UX problem, because managing Lightning channels and that whole, how that whole system works is not super intuitive and not super user-friendly, in my opinion. But yeah, I'm technology open. I love all tech, especially if it's built on Bitcoin. And so we're open to everything.
Got it. And then, yeah, so we're in the high experimentation phase of L2s. I feel like we're also in that with stablecoins. We're getting a lot of new entrants to the market. Do we have too many stablecoins? Like, how do you see experimentation and, like, longer term? Is there going to be consolidation? Like, how do you see the market going?
I think it's the classical adoption of technology where it's just a lot of experimentation, a lot of ideas, a lot of teams, a lot of good, you know, projects, some not that good projects. And that's what we're in right now. There's probably like 20 different stablecoins that are coming to Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is a stablecoins are a network effect business. So we will certainly see consolidation over the years and a couple winners emerge. Who those will be, who knows? Right? It's not the time to see that. It's so early. So it's going to be years to really see that materialize.
Got it. What's on the last couple questions? This has been great. What's on the roadmap for Hermetica, say the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, I mean, for us, always be making the product better. We're going through a whole UI UX redesign, which is a big focus of mine right now, actually. And then deploying to other L2s as they come online and being active in those ecosystems. And then obviously there's a big focus on decentralizing our protocol and potentially launching a token with that. And lastly, and this maybe ties back to the beginning of our conversation, is the adoption in Bitcoin DeFi is super interesting to us because there's emergent, you know, new ecosystem in crypto. But there's also just real adoption in emerging markets that is fascinating for me specifically and very, very relevant for stablecoins. So we're looking at those markets, emerging markets in Africa and Latin America and Asia, where we can find partners and distribution to actually bring our stablecoin and our yield solution to those folks, because there's a lot of opportunity to serve those people. That's what we're really excited about.
Very cool. Question that just came to mind, because a lot of apps that go cross-chain, especially in the DeFi world, have a big issue with fragmented liquidity. Like, you go to a new ecosystem, no one knows you, your brand is over on, you know, some other ecosystem, and so you have to almost start fresh and try to get those people to trust you to put their money in there. But it seems like the way you have this constructed, you don't have as much of those kind of like headaches to deal with. Am I hearing that correctly, or like think about that right?
I think that it is a big issue. Fragmenting liquidity is because you also create like DeFi pools that are specific to a specific token standard and are locked into that ecosystem. And that liquidity just sits there, right? And can be accessed from other L2s. I think it's a massive issue, to be honest. And I think there's not a really clear, good solution yet to that. And we'll have to figure it out as we explore, as we expand the ecosystems. I think there's some cool cross-chain stuff like Beyond just came out. That is like using layer zero technology to do like interoperability across a lot of different L2s, which is, I think, super fascinating. And at the end of the day, that's probably the end game, where it doesn't really matter where you, like at the end game is really that the user doesn't even know what chain they're on and what token standard they're using. It's just abstracted away and be, you know, stuff like Beyond and other interoperability tech is behind the scenes. So I think it's just like we're in like the first 10% of adoption or even less, and it's all clunky and weird and not efficient. And as we adopt more, we'll probably get that sorted out, or we have to get that sorted out for mass adoption.
Yeah. So does USDH have that same issue in the sense of like you have these high net worth people that are willing to deploy Bitcoin and they put it towards somewhere, and are they in the background kind of like the market maker? So they're being the liquidity pool that if you're going to go put it on, you know, rootstock, for example, a certain subset of that treasure has to be put towards rootstock to then trade against?
Yeah, I mean, you can think of it essentially as there's Bitcoin in the protocol on the asset side, and then there's the stable coins on the liability side that are either issued on runes or on stacks right now or in the future on rootstock and other L2s. So those assets can be interoperable, and we're working actually on an in-house solution to make them bridgeable without actually using a bridge, just through us. But in general, if a token is on one equal, like if there's a Ruins USDH, then and that is sitting in a pool on DotSwap for people to trade against, that liquidity is siloed from the liquidity on stacks, right? They're not, like they can't talk to each other. They can't interact with each other, at least not yet. And that is... it's not capital efficient, right? Because if there's a lot of liquidity here, but you're trading over here and there's not a lot of liquidity, then that is a user problem. And yeah, we need to fix that at some point. But
got it.
I don't see a good solution there. I don't know if you have any startups that do that. Maybe that's a startup idea.
I mean, Beyond is doing good work. Like it's always, you just move trust assumptions around. You're playing trust assumption ping pong at some level. Like it's, you trust layer zero, or you trust something else. So like, there's no perfect solution in my mind yet, but yeah. So we'll see. It's a big enough problem. There's enough money to be made if someone solves it. Someone will. It's gonna happen. Absolutely. But you got me thinking, because there's a big topic in Bitcoin around decentralization. Obviously, like censorship resistance, and I'm of the view now in 2024 that like it's a good target. Perfect is the enemy of good for a lot of these products, where it's like just build what's useful first so we're not lagging behind TradFi and the ETFs taking all of it. And as I'm sitting here, like you've definitely sat in the middle of that, of you're partially centralized on part of your stack, partially decentralized on like the smart contract side of like where custody is. So like when you're thinking about how to build for usefulness and utility while like towing that line, how did you think about it when you were building this?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. I fully agree with your sentiment in that I think decentralization has to be our North Star and has to be what we thrive to do in the long term, because that ensures that the systems actually stay independent and can serve people in the future. But in order to move quickly and bring products to market that actually then create that virtuous cycle of actually becoming better because they're used and they're not just ideas in people's heads and get like over optimized, which a lot of people I think fall into that trap. In order to do that quick iteration and bring products to market, I think having that scale go further into centralization and have some elements that are centralized is probably better actually, because it allows you to have that quick feedback loop. And if I'm quite honest, I mean, I'm a Bitcoiner. I love decentralization. I love Bitcoin. And I think that's what we should strive for. But if you look at the general public, I don't think they care, to be honest. I think most people don't care about centralization. I mean, you see that with stablecoin adoption. How centralized are stablecoins? 100%. is like centralized in the entity and centralized by being backed by the US government, essentially. So like, doesn't get more centralized than that. Massive adoption and lots of use cases, and very useful use cases for a lot of people all over the world that are actually getting real economic value out of these things. So I think we have to be very careful as an ecosystem to not, as you said, over-optimize for decentralization and then get caught in our like internal little feedback loop that is screaming on Twitter, which then actually prevents us from building products that are useful, that get feedback and can iterate. And yeah, so I fall definitely into the let's do a compromise camp.
Yep. And thank you for that. We need more thinking like that. So partially I'm trying to call it out because, yeah, you get shouted down on Twitter if you say this, you're a heretic, all these things. How could you? You're just trying to be fiat again, clown world. And it's like, come on, bro. We're trying to build useful shit.
Can decentralize over time. Like, you can start out 100%. Less decentralized and then bring it into that over time. And that's also what we're aiming for.
Love it. Love it. No, that's very good. Very cool. Cool, man. The last question, I always end on a high note of like, what are you most excited about in Bitcoin? It could be your own product. It could be some new tech, or just something you're excited about in the world. What's got you hyped right now?
I mean, there's a lot of things I think to be hyped about. On the product side, I'm really excited about Bitcoin staking and stuff that Babylon is building. I think that is a really cool primitive that is actually really interesting to us because we can implement a yield on that level, like a risk-free rate essentially into our protocol as well. And I think it will really make the whole ecosystem better. And it makes fundamental sense to me to use Bitcoin's one of its most prevalent characteristics, which is this high security budget, and use that across other ecosystems. Like, that makes fundamental sense. And so I'm excited about that product and how it's going to be rolled out. Obviously, still very early days. I think there is a palpable, on a different note, there's a palpable change in the regulatory and legislative landscape, especially in the US, with Trump and people around that. I think people are fed up with basically being stonewalled by nonsense and really want to create innovation also through the US. I think that is exciting and hopefully will be coming more in the coming months and years.
Fingers crossed. Fingers, please give us regulatory clarity. That would be so needed. Yes. Excellent. Any topics that I didn't ask that you want to close on?
No, I think we talked about most everything. Really appreciate it. Great conversation. I love your podcast. Always been a listener for actually many years.
Thank you so much. And thank you for coming on, dropping knowledge. My work is cut out for me to cut out all the banger clips and bombs that you dropped. So, I think the people are going to enjoy this one. Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Most fun.
Thank you for listening this far into the episode. If you found it enjoyable, please do like, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. YouTube does me a huge favor to like and subscribe. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain. Show me some love. I reply to every DM. And if you are a Bitcoin builder that is kind of at the forefront of building new use cases, whether it's L1, Lightning, Stacks, Rootstock, Rollups, Ordinals, BRC20, I want to talk to you. So when I'm not doing this podcast, I am the sourcing partner at the Bitcoin Frontier Fund, where we invest in Bitcoin startups at the earliest stages, give you access to whatever you need, whether it's legal, product, fundraising help, as well as capital. So love to talk to you. You can hit me up again. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain and shoot me a DM. I'll read everything. Love to talk to you guys. All right, peace. It's gone up. We playing the long game to the black rock chains, with the racks paid off from the blockchain. Going up high octane, so we up in here like Palmer. Making big noise, big money. Go play with your kid toys. You funny, I'm counting my Bitcoin. We up and we been gone. It's gone up. Planned it out and we did this purposefully. Panning out like the kitchen currently. It's like surgery. Way it's earning me. A nurse's salary for cryptocurrency. I'm on a vacay drinking coconuts while wearing polka dots. This ain't no hocus pocus. Listen up and learn. It's gone up.